Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities with Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. After more than a decade in D.C., Congresswoman Elise Stefanik has set her sights on Albany. The Republican from the North Country announced her bid for New York's top job last week. She's aiming to unseat Democratic Governor Kathy Hochul. The New York Public News Network's Emily Russell spoke with voters in the Adirondacks who find flaws in both candidates.
Elise Stefanik was first elected to represent the North Country in Congress in 2014. Back then, she was seen as a moderate and pledged to be a fresh voice in Washington. On the morning Stefanik announced her bid for governor, I meet Zebulon Edwards at a gas station in Raybrook. He's a Democrat and says he appreciated how Stefanik governed in those early years.
I would say probably her first like 3-4 years was great. I actually really liked her. And then she kind of took a turn, and it seems like things have gone in a different direction with her, and I don't support that anymore.
Edwards is referring to Stefanik's hard shift to the right and her unwavering loyalty to President Donald Trump. When it comes to Governor Kathy Hochul, Edwards says his opinions are mixed.
I would like to see somebody else run for governor.
As a Democrat or Republican?
Either one. I don't really have a preference for either party right now. I just want to see something fresh, something new.
Hochul has struggled to build support in rural upstate regions like the North Country. She lost every county here in 2022. The widest margin was in Lewis County, where she earned less than 18% of the vote. Dan Olson is a school bus driver from Saranac Lake. He's a registered Republican and is critical of some of Hochul's mandates, like her push for electric school buses and all-electric home appliances.
It seems like she likes to ban a lot of things, like ban gas stoves. You know, all houses have to be electric by a certain date. And electric heat is really expensive, especially around here.
Olson believes Stefanik understands those issues, and he thinks she'd bring more federal dollars to the state since she's got close ties to Trump. But Olson would also like to see Stefanik stand on her own and put some distance between herself and the president.
I think she really needs to be a more independent thinker. And hopefully, if she does get elected to this new position, hopefully she can kind of de-align herself with the president.
But other Republicans see Stefanik's self-described ultra-MAGA stance as a good thing. James Walker is a registered Republican and lives out near Bloomingdale. I meet him sipping coffee in a gas station. Walker thinks Stefanik's loyalty to Trump will help her in the governor's race.
There's a lot of people in this area that are for Donald Trump, so I don't think that's really going to hurt her chances.
But statewide, Democrats outweigh Republicans by a 2-to-1 margin. A Republican hasn't won the governor's race in New York since 2002. There are also more than 3 million voters unaffiliated with any political party. Walker has voted for Stefanik in every election and is happy she's trying to oust Hochul from the top job.
I think Kathy Hochul is dragging us down. I'm a retired correction officer, and she didn't really do good for the correction officers.
Hochul fired about 2,000 corrections officers after they illegally went on strike and then refused to return to work once the state reached a deal with the union representing COs. Inside a cafe in downtown Saranac Lake, Lisa Meissner and her husband are out for breakfast. They're both Democrats. Meissner is critical of Stefanik's voting record, especially her support for Trump's big tax bill this summer, which will make massive cuts to Medicaid. That program provides health coverage to more than 30% of folks in the North Country.
I mean, we could lose all our hospitals in the North Country because of her actions. So that, I don't think she's serving us.
Meissner says she's not wild about Governor Hochul, but she thinks Stefanik could be really dangerous for New York.
I'm hopeful she has no chance, but we also have to be very mindful and not take it for granted.
The last time Hochul was challenged by a Republican, Lee Zeldin, she won by just a narrow 6-point margin. The latest independent poll released in September had Hochul leading Stefanik by 25 points. New York has long been seen as a solidly blue state, though it saw the biggest swing of Republican voters nationwide in last year's election. In Saranac Lake, I'm Emily Russell for the New York Public News Network.
Meanwhile, the Legislative Gazette's Jesse Taylor reports Congresswoman Stefanik's political opponent, Governor Kathy Hochul, is calling her a sellout.
Stefanik has been teasing a run for governor for months, neither confirming nor denying an intention to run. But that changed when the outspoken defender and ally of President Donald Trump made her announcement. Afterwards, the 21st District Congresswoman appeared on the talk show Fox and Friends.
I'm running for governor to make New York affordable and safe. We have seen decades of single-party rule led by Democrats, and Kathy Hochul is the worst governor in America. New York is the most unaffordable state in the nation.
Hochul is firing back, drawing attention to Stefanik's close relationship to President Trump, who lost to Kamala Harris in New York State in the 2024 election, 53% to 46%, and in 2016 to Hillary Clinton, 57% to 33%. An ad released by Hochul's re-election campaign blasted the gubernatorial hopeful.
Meet Elise Stefanik.
The greatest president in the history of our country, President Donald J. Trump.
She's Donald Trump's top ally in Congress.
I'm proud to be one of his top allies on Capitol Hill. This goes back to fighting against the witch hunt impeachment. It goes back to being the first member of Congress who endorsed him.
Now Elise Stefanik is running for governor of New York.
Stefanik has been a staunch defender for much of Trump's political career, but that hasn't always been the case. Before becoming Trump's fervent ally, she had kept him at arm's length. Her shifting attitude toward Trump was documented on WAMC's Congressional Corner when she appeared on the program multiple times between 2015 and 2017. On August 18, 2015, then-host Alan Chartok asked Stefanik whether or not she thought Trump was insulting toward women.
He has been insulting to women. I think that his comments about Megyn Kelly, who is, you know, actually went to law school in Albany, so she's very familiar with upstate New York. I was deeply concerned about those comments, and we are a long way out from the Iowa caucus and the New Hampshire primary. I think this may be Mr. Trump's peak moment.
Earlier that month, Trump had made public comments about Kelly's menstruation cycle, saying, quote, "You could see the blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever." Later in the interview, Chartok asked for Stefanik's opinion on the 2016 presidential race.
I'm watching the presidential race very closely in both parties, but I'm not picking a horse as of yet.
Appearing on the program again on December 2nd, 2015, the then-freshman congresswoman said she was looking forward to embracing bipartisanship.
There's going to be an increasing willingness to work across the aisle. I think that's a characteristic of my generation, and I'm already finding that with some of the new colleagues on the Democratic side. We're trying to work together on education policy, for example.
After Trump won the presidency and began serving his first term, Stefanik appeared on the Congressional Corner again on February 23, 2017, about a month after the new president was sworn in. In that interview with Chartok, Stefanik was asked if she was pleased with the Trump administration.
So tell me, are you either pleased or not pleased or somewhere in the middle with what's going on in, with the Trump administration these days? A lot of people are talking about, you know, chaos, using big words like that. What do you think?
What I think is, you know, my job is to be the most effective member of Congress I can be. And I'm going to work with this administration on issues where I agree and where I disagree. I'll continue saying that I disagree. I do think that as you're, going through the appointment process and filling these roles, which are incredibly important in a very large federal government, there could be some growing pains in the sense that getting the appointments through the Senate, which has been slower than at any other point in history, we need to make sure that we have personnel in these positions to ensure a smooth and effective and efficient federal government. But my role in Congress is to work with anybody, whether they're in the administration, whether they're Democrats in the Senate, Democrats in the House, my fellow Republicans, on issues that are important to my district.
Those utterances are a stark contrast from the rhetoric of the now 10-year Republican congresswoman who has repeatedly defended Trump and has become his close political ally. Just last week, Stefanik appeared on Fox News' The Faulkner Focus and commented on the government shutdown, which has now entered into its 38th day. During the interview, she blamed Democrats.
And the reality is, this is a Democrat Senate-led shutdown. This is the same bill. It's a clean funding bill that House Republicans passed that every Republican senator voted for. Democrats own this shutdown, and it's going to have real hurt across America. I'm already hearing from my constituents, whether it's air traffic controllers, whether it's TSA agents, or whether it's those on SNAP benefits who really need those lifelines. So when we talk about Americans going hungry, this impacts every district across the country. Chuck Schumer needs to vote for the bill that during Joe Biden's presidency, he voted for 13 times. And now they're trying to leverage the American people to shut down the government.
Stefanik's gubernatorial announcement means there are now officially three contenders vying for governor. Former Lieutenant Governor Antonio Delgado, Kathy Hochul, and Elise Stefanik. I'm Jesse Taylor.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Dan Clark, Albany Bureau Chief for the Times Union, to talk about how lawmakers in Albany will receive New York City Mayor-elect Zohran Mamdani's campaign proposals.
The governor is a little bit more conservative with her spending, especially with the state facing a budget gap in this coming year of about $4 billion. It's not a small amount of money. Of course, Mayor-elect Mamdani, his tax plan, if it was enacted, would blow that right out of the water. I mean, it would be so much money coming in. That being said, there is a real fear that if you do raise taxes on high-income earners and big corporations, that they will move out of the state. What a lot of people don't know is that I think it's the top 1% of earners, or the highest percentage, generate about half of our income tax revenue. And this is a small number of people. So every one of them that leaves the state is a big hit on our tax revenue. At the same time, the number of millionaires in New York has continued to increase. So one could argue that these higher tax rates are actually having an effect on out-migration or anything of the like. With the free buses, it's the same thing. Funding, funding, funding. Where is the money going to come from? And in a year where the state is anticipating that budget gap, along with a $10 billion budget gap in the year to follow, Governor Hochul is not going to have an incentive to raise costs on people in a way that could impact revenue down the line.
And yet, Dan Clark, she endorsed him.
Yes.
For the mayorship, and he has not expressed that similar endorsement for her coming 2026 run.
Right, and his excuse for that is that the governor has not yet asked for her endorsement, and I understand that. However, her endorsement of him is going to be used as a boogeyman for Republicans for the entire election cycle coming up.
Already has been by the other candidate that's now in the race we haven't mentioned, Elise Stefanik.
Yes, exactly. And not even just that race. It'll be happening in congressional races around the state and around the country. You'll see people in Texas running for office, and the Republican opponent will use Mayor-elect Mamdani because now he is the face of the Democratic Party. It is a frustrating time, I think, for Democrats in that sense, but they're also doing the same thing with President Donald Trump. He's the boogeyman for the left. So it's a situation where we'll have this kind of proxy war in politics, where people aren't really running against each other. They're running against each other's proxies.
And there's a wedge in there called Antonio Delgado.
Yes.
The lieutenant governor who is turned against his governor is running against her. And he aligns more with Mamdani in New York City than Governor Hochul does. So you can kind of see the move by Hochul there. But I don't get the sense that his campaign yet has any real legs. And yet here he is. What's his motivation? He's former congressman. He got out of that race. It looked like the purple district wasn't going to go his way. Then he becomes the lieutenant governor candidate. Now he's lieutenant governor. Then he says, I don't like this anymore. I'm leaving. Governor Hochul says, good riddance. We didn't want you back anyway. Now she's looking for another running mate.
Yeah, I mean, the lieutenant governor has a tough job because a lot of people around the state don't know who he is, despite being on the ticket in 2022 and a lot of people voting for him. He hasn't raised that profile enough to really make an impact in the polls. If you look at polls around him, it's not so much favorability and unfavorability. It's that a lot of people just don't know whether they want to find him favorable. That's his challenge over the next several months as we lead into the June primary. It's not an impossible thing to do. He's trying to really court the left part of the Democratic Party. And as we saw with Mamdani, that was successful in his case. The problem is that the governor has institutional support from the state party, from really any mainstream Democrat around the state. And if they get into the party chairs and everything, everyone at the ground level, this is a primary, not a general election. Democrats are going to be making this choice. So if she has them, she wins over Delgado.
Well, it's so interesting to me because the governor keeps some certain decisions very close to the vest. So, for example, you saw Delgado appearing with the Compassion and Choices Group, the medical aid in dying legislation, and supporting that. But Hochul, not so much. She has not indicated which way she's going. And I know for a fact Compassion and Choices are worried about what that decision is going to be. Also, you have the Patients' Rights Coalition on the other side. And this definitional thing of, is it physician-assisted suicide or is it death with dignity? And right in the middle of this is Governor Hochul.
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue for her. It's defined in a lot of different ways. The governor is thought to be inclined to sign this bill because it has to do with, at the very root, bodily autonomy. She is big on abortion. And of course, those two issues are not the same thing, but they both deal with bodily autonomy. So the thought is that she will sign it. However, we do know that it will be used against her politically across the state. I mean, as people see this, somebody who's had a family member with a terminal illness may see this differently from somebody who has lost a family member due to suicide that didn't have a terminal illness. That's the balancing act that she has to take. And whether that works out for her politically is another question. But if she does veto it and Antonio Delgado did support it, that could lend some support his way as well.
That's Dan Clark, author of Capital Confidential and Albany bureau chief for the Times Union. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Lawmakers in Washington voted to reopen the federal government this week, but impacts of the longest shutdown in history are likely to have a lasting impact, including in the Capital Region. The Legislative Gazette's Samantha Simmons reports.
With lawmakers coming to an agreement to end the 43-day shutdown late Wednesday, some are celebrating the now reopened valve of funding coming back to the American people, but others are highlighting that challenges will likely still remain. President Donald Trump signed the funding bill Wednesday night, which should help restore flight schedules to full capacity and end the disruption of services to programs like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Despite the expected dispersal of funds, including paychecks returning to the roughly 1.4 million federal workers who have gone without pay or who were furloughed during the six-week shutdown, impacts are likely to continue. Federal employees were directed to return to work Thursday in a memo from Director of the Office of Management and Budget, Russell Vought. In that memo, Vought thanked employees for their, quote, continued work on behalf of the American people to usher in President Trump's golden age of America, unquote. Melinda Person is the president of New York State United Teachers. She says members of the organization, which represents more than 700,000 people in New York's schools, colleges, and healthcare facilities, will feel the impacts of the shutdown for weeks or months to come.
Just because the shutdown is over doesn't mean our advocacy efforts are over, because the SNAP cuts are still coming. Those were in the One Big Beautiful Bill Act that passed. And so we can expect to see a lot more food insecurity in our students and in our communities.
Person says teachers and other school leaders have come together in recent weeks to fill the gap in resources for families who need support. She says while kids in New York schools have access to free breakfast and lunch, their families need support to feed them outside of school hours, a concern that was exacerbated during the shutdown.
We're going to be enhancing our efforts to do backpack programs where we send food home with kids after school, over the weekends, during school breaks when they're away from us for a week. We have the kids may not get enough food during those time periods, and so we're going to be stepping up our efforts to make sure we take care of kids even outside of the school hours.
Congressional Democrats had initially voted against a measure that would have kept the government open in October in an effort to fight for the extension of Affordable Care Act tax credits set to expire at the end of the year. But after eight senators defected, the bill passed Wednesday did not directly address the issue. Instead, Republicans have agreed to hold a separate vote next month on the extension of the tax credits. As a result of the shutdown, SNAP benefits ceased November 1st before the Trump administration agreed to restore partial funding following orders from federal judges. As of Wednesday night, electronic benefit transfer cards have been reloaded and participants can once again use their benefits. But despite that, and support from New York State, Susan Littner from the Regional Food Bank says impacts from the One Big Beautiful Bill Act are imminent.
Able-bodied adults without dependents, otherwise referred to as ABONs, which are people who, for one reason or another, do not work and receive benefits. They will have to either work or volunteer a certain number of hours within a three-year period in order to continue to receive SNAP benefits. Of course, we want everyone to have access and opportunities for employment. But we also are aware that there are certain areas of our service area that opportunities do not exist, and now those individuals may not have access to those benefits. We also know that there are people who are primary caretakers for family members with disabilities or elderly parents who they need to care for, and those folks also will not be eligible for benefits.
In addition to support like subsidies and tax credits, the federal government also provides benefits to its own employees. But Katie Rader, a political science professor at the University at Albany, says with the shutdown and other moves made by the Trump administration this term, people may be thinking twice about working for the federal government.
One notable piece of this shutdown was this question mark over whether furloughed workers were going to get paid. That hasn't been necessarily a part of the debate previously, and having that, you know, the continuing resolution did include that stipulation and that promise for those furloughed workers. So, you know, I think it raises a lot of questions as they're going back to work, and it has, you know, for yes, they're going to get paid back, but I think for myself, losing 40 days of my paycheck, what kinds of things happened in that period of time that that I wouldn't necessarily get to pay back. The screaming sacrifices for their own lives.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Samantha Simmons.
The nation honored veterans this week, and the Albany County Legislature and Albany County Executive Dan McCoy unveiled banners honoring veterans of the Capital Region. The Legislative Gazette's Mariam Hamed was there for the unveiling.
The banners in the Thelma P. Lally School of Education building on the former campus of the College of St. Rose are part of an ongoing effort to recognize the contributions and sacrifices of veterans from World War I, World War II, the Vietnam War, and onwards. The county plans to unveil another round of banners before Memorial Day next year. 22 veterans were honored Friday, adding to 11 others who were honored in May. Albany County Executive Dan McCoy said the banners were made to honor the bravery and dedication of veterans from the Capital Region. Specialist Michelle Longmire, who was born and raised in Cohoes, was in attendance with his family and said he was honored to be recognized. Longmire served with the 2nd and 16th Rangers in the Vietnam War and was sent out during the Tet Offensive, one of the largest military campaigns of the war.
I'll be 82 years old next week, and I never expected to be here to see this or anything like this. It's just heartwarming to be here.
Longmire was especially grateful to be there with his family.
I have family that helps take care of me, the grandchildren, and they're all around me. My children, grandchildren, and one, some that I helped raise, they're all been around me, and they're here today.
Sergeant Terry Kinlan, longtime defense attorney in Albany, was the third generation of his family to serve in the armed forces. He served in Vietnam and was injured and medically retired in 1968.
I quit college and joined the Marine Corps in 1966, went to Vietnam, was shot during the Tet Offensive, and ended up medically retired. So in certain circles, I'm still a sergeant.
Kinlan was there to see the banners unveiled along with his son, Albany County District Attorney Lee Kinlan, who said that recognizing veterans was a civic responsibility for Albany.
Today is a great day to recognize all the contributions that veterans have had to the city of Albany, and it's really nice to see the city and the county of Albany acknowledging that service, because it's such an important part of our civic responsibility.
Some of the veterans honored lost their lives while deployed, like Specialist Hayes Coleman's friend, Wilbert Branch. Coleman served in the Army in Vietnam as well, from 1959 to 1962. He pointed to Branch's banner and told the story of his shock at losing his friend.
Wilbert Branch, he was one of my best friends, and he got killed in the Philippines. I was working at that time, and I heard it on the radio, and I couldn't believe it. I said, he just went back. Yeah, because he got caught in a storm in January. And he got caught in a storm. He was here. He was supposed to go back, but the traffic wasn't, I mean, the planes wasn't flying, and he was late getting back. And then they shipped him straight to the Philippines. He wasn't there but 3 days.
Longmire also mourned the friends he lost while deployed during the second phase of the Tet Offensive, which in May 1968 killed more than 2,400 American troops.
I had a lot of friends that I lost in that, and you can't never replace that. And you never replace the people you lost. And I don't know where the ones that survived that came back home, I don't know where they are now or anything like that, but I would love to see them and unite with them.
I'm Mariam Ahmed.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. With help from the New York Public News Network, you can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2546. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.